I'm Stuart Sheldon.
My name's Ron Rothberg.
30 years ago, I was on Wall Street. I was the youngest vice president at my fancy company, but that's not what I wanted to do.
After spending nearly 25 years in media, I knew things were changing, both in the industry and inside me.
Swan Dive shares the powerful stories of those who had the clarity and backbone to make a major life pivot to their vision.
I took a swan dive.
I have been an artist ever since, and it's the best choice I ever made.
Getting closer to who you really are. That's Swan Dive. Award-winning author and trial attorney Jonathan Miller took 10 years to finish his first book, and then he wrote a dozen more.
You know, what is your hero trying to learn? What are his wants and needs? What are her wants and needs? And once I focused on that, and once I had the beginning, the middle, and the end, that's what you've got to focus on. What are you trying to do in your book? And if you don't know that, it'll never be finished.
Figuring out the hero's journey and taking a leap toward finishing what is unfinished. This is Swan Dive. From the Peacock and Park Studios, somewhere on the road to life, this is another edition of Swan Dive, coming to you from the Fancy Nasty Studios in Costa Rica. It's Stu Sheldon and me, Ron Rothberg, coming to you right now from Zion National Park, one of the most beautiful national treasures we have in this here country. Welcome to Swan Dive.
Hey, buddy, it's nice to hear. Usually I'm the guy in the most beautiful place, but you win, I think. I went backcountry in Zion as in my 20s, camping with some friends, and tell me about what you see right now. What are you looking at?
The sun is now coming up over the mountains. We're in the campground here. We're just surrounded by multicolored peaks. The trees are all with their shimmering yellow leaves that are just about to fall. We thought we were done with autumn, but autumn has just hit the valley in Zion. So the colors of the yellow against the red of the cliffs is absolutely one of the greatest portraits I've seen in a very, very long time.
Yeah, someone's inspired. I like it.
Mm. I'm inspired to hear another episode of Swan Dive, though, Stu.
I am. You know, we talked last week about an earlier episode called Unfinished, and the take-home message from that episode, you know, we're all unfinished, and so what are you going to do about it? And so the implied message is, what action will you take? Our guest today has taken a lot of interesting action in a very unique space. So let's get right to it. I'm going to introduce our guest today, Jonathan Miller. He's a public defender. He's an award-winning novelist. John grew up in New Mexico in Albuquerque with a vision of practicing environmental law. He studied urban and regional planning at Cornell. He went to law school. Then he worked at the Department of the Interior in D.C. until budget cuts sent him packing back to New Mexico. He then landed a gig as a public defender in Roswell, New Mexico. Yes, that Roswell. And on the drive down to Roswell, John saw a road sign that said, "Watch for rattlesnakes." And at that moment, he was inspired to write a book called Rattlesnake Lawyer. We're going to talk about that book and other books he's written subsequently. Still an active criminal defense attorney, John has in fact written 13 novels to date. His law firm is called Rattlesnake Law. John, welcome to Swan Dive.
It's great to be here. I actually did my honeymoon in Arches in Moab. So I know how beautiful it is around there, and I've never been to Costa Rica, but I'd love to go.
Well, you have an invite.
Brother. Well, you'll be here one day. Let's get right into this, because your first book is about being a public defender in Roswell. Title is Rattlesnake Lawyer. Am I right?
That is correct. And I had been working in D.C. Things sort of went south in my life, literally. And I ended up back in New Mexico, and I see that sign called Rattlesnake Law, Watch for Rattlesnakes. And I started taping all my thoughts, and I left the jail door open. My first visit to the Roswell jail, I left the jail open. I thought it was going to be automatic. And I had all these other experiences, and it was just coming alive.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you, you know, Roswell, I suspect, is a relatively small town, and you leave this sort of high, high-profile job in D.C. working for the Department of the Interior. Now you're the public defender in a small, bizarre town. What did you learn, and what was it like to fictionalize your daily life at that time?
Well, when it began, I intended to write a sort of a tell-all book. And the way I did it is I just literally was speaking my words into a tape recorder of the funny things that happened. And, you know, for example, I had my hair cut by the mother of a killer. And the question is, how much do you tip? It was a crappy hair. It was a crappy haircut.
Well, wasn't it a killer haircut?
Ooh.
Yeah, it was. And, you know, I felt guilty. I bought a shirt from the owner. You know, I was starting out in juvenile law, which was good because there was still hope for the clients. And I wasn't the public defender. I was one of many. And actually one of five. My supervisor certainly called me the yuppie back then. That was it. And now I'm neither young, urban, nor professional. So, and the other thing about a town of Roswell is it had about 45,000 people. And since I wasn't making that much money, I lived with my clients in the same complex.
Wait a minute. So you're like, there was some sort of like, waiting for trial housing kind of, what does that look like?
Well, no, I was in the one apartment complex in the town, which has been since been condemned. I would run into the mothers and the clients of, you know, getting my mail or at restaurants all around town. It was very intimate.
Does that give you a different perspective or does that make you more sympathetic?
It did at the time because I could empathize with these people. And they're also filming a movie there. And the late River Phoenix was in the movie, and one of the craziest things that happened is I confused River Phoenix with one of my clients. I'm like, that's my client there. Why is he doing? He's supposed to be in jail, and it was the late River Phoenix. And that was really odd, is that I became much more sympathetic to the people going through things. Because I'd been waitlisted at Cornell and people were waitlisted at treatment. And I sort of understood the impatience that people had when they're waiting for justice to arrive.
Yeah. Full disclosure to our listeners, my father and Ron's father, John and I met at Cornell. In fact, we were roommates for both of our final years. We both kind of found extra rooms with a bunch of dudes. And that's when we first encountered one another, but we haven't really spoken much in the last three decades. So it's kind of fun for me to catch up on John's life, especially given how colorful it is. Yeah. What I'm really intrigued by, John, is this idea that you really had a focus in terms of environmental law and really working to make the world and the environment a better and more sustainable place. And then all of a sudden you had this sort of epiphany as an artist. Would you describe that moment when you saw that sign as a swan dive or as your swan dive?
It is because I started writing and I started keeping a diary. And then within a month, this is how crazy it is. I sent it off since I'd been in D.C. I sent it off to three D.C. lawyer agents. And I had an agent within a month. And I was actually optioned by the end of my first year in Roswell by a major corporation that you've heard of. And I would get a decent amount of money from it. However, the book would take 10 years before it was published. And it kept getting optioned because people love the idea of a fish out of water, an East Coast, you know, even though I'm from New Mexico, I sort of, you know, I'd gone to Cornell and thought I was a big deal. And all of a sudden I'm in Roswell, where people know more about life and law than I did.
Yeah.
Right. What did that 10 years take you to teach you about fortitude?
It taught me a lot because I had, you know, there was one time in a few years after, and I've got to be very delicate when I say this. When they found out I was writing a book, I was told, if you wrote about anyone here, you will be fired. If you violated one single client confidence, you will be disbarred. Wow. And I was just fired because I wrote about my boss. And so then I kept writing and rewriting and rewriting, and I decided that I had to fictionalize it. And
Wait a minute. You were actually fired for writing about your boss?
Yes, I was.
At what point was this in that first year?
It was after my – I was in Roswell from the age of 28 and a half to 30. So about a year in, they found out that I was writing, and my boss and the district defender came in, and both of them are long since retired, and read the manuscript. And they wanted – there was one line where a woman had shouted something. And if this was before the internet, if she had shouted it on TV, that would not be privileged. But if she had just shouted it to us, I could have been disbarred because I was revealing a confidence. Needless to say, that line is out of the book.
Would it be safe to say that the rattlesnake bit you?
It did. And I, you know, but then I got serious about it, and I would eventually, even though I would start practicing law over New Mexico, the book, the joke that I often make is everyone said my book wasn't compelling, so I moved to L.A., another swan dive, to learn compulsion.
And did you become compulsive and obsessive?
I did. I went to the American Film Institute screenwriting program. I have an MFA in screenwriting. That's another swan dive when I moved to LA. And I learned some basic things, and I'm going to save everyone $100,000 in tuition. A book's got to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. People have to have character arcs. In the middle of the book, there has to be the inmost cave, the whole hero's journey. And I went through my manuscript, which at the time was, here's a funny story. Oh, wait, another funny story. Oh, I got another funny story too. Dan is an innocent. He goes to a place. All of a sudden, he meets a client who knows more than he does. Then they've got to prepare for the trial. They have the trial. And at the end, Dan learns a valuable lesson, which is that his client knew more about everything than he did. And that made it into a book.
Well, you know, clearly you've learned something and you've done something right, because you've won some awards now for some of your books within New Mexico, and you're garnering praise among your peers. My question to you would be, as an artist, as a painter, you know, one style, I didn't even have a style for 5 years. And then in the last 15 years, you know, 20 years, my style has evolved. Has your style evolved as a writer? And are you broadening the genre? What genres do you write in? And are those genres broadening? Are you writing in different genres?
My books are always legal thrillers. There's always a lawyer, but I wanted to experiment. My last book was called The Shakespeare Incident, because there's a town called Shakespeare, New Mexico. And I wrote a UFO legal thriller. And that book, The Shakespeare Incident, won Best Science Fiction at the New Mexico Book Awards. And I wanted to prove, and like I said, I wanted to prove that I could write a character that clearly was not me. So I wanted to write a female multiracial character who has imposter syndrome in a small town. But I wrote a straight up UFO story. But it's a legal thriller. And this actually was inspired by something in Roswell, where I had a client who said the aliens made him do it. I raised competency, and in real life, we got his case dismissed. But suppose he was telling the truth. And now you have a novel.
You know, I want to take a sidebar here, and that is that, you know, at the top, I talked about this idea of being unfinished and about that implication of there's work yet to do. And work yet to do means sitting on your ass and typing out the book, or in this case, in John's case, 13 books over 20 years. And I just want to applaud you for doing the work, man. You know, whether any of us get rich and famous from the work that we do, I tell my kids, it's about doing the work, trying hard, being committed, being creative, being enthused, having fresh ideas, all of these things that you are clearly doing. And I just want to shout you out because I think it's incredibly impressive and admirable, and good on you, my friend. Well done.
Thank you. And, you know, I alternate books. I alternate, you know, there's the famous line, one for me, one for them, where I write books. All the books, the Dan Shepard Rattlesnake Lawyer books, are written in the first person. When I write as another character, I write in the third person. And I created the character of Luna Cruz, who is Latina and lives in a small town and then gets extremely successful. But she has all sorts of issues. And Dan and Luna get married, get divorced, have all sorts of other adventures. Dan had a son who had some issues. And I wrote a book called Rattlesnake and Son, which was, again, I wanted to deal with, I don't know why, even though I don't believe in psychic issues, I wanted to write a book where a kid was a psychic. And I wanted to, you know, just focus on a whole different genre within the legal thriller area. So I will combine everything. I actually have written a straight up Western where a lawyer has to rescue a woman, and soon they're on the run from the bad guys through the Navajo reservation. So I wanted to write variety of styles and still do it within the legal thriller genre.
And regardless of the styles, it seems like there's always that opportunity to get stuck. Do you have the formula for unsticking when you get stuck?
When I was, you know, when I was in film school, everyone would say, "What is the book about?" And that got, "What are you trying to do here? What is, you know, what is your hero trying to learn? What are his wants and needs? What are her wants and needs?" And once I focused on that, and once I had the beginning, the middle, and an end, you know, my first book took 10 years. I've outlined books and gotten decent first drafts in a matter of weeks that I can do now. So, again, that's what you've got to focus on. What are you trying to do in your book? And if you don't know that, it'll never be finished.
Is it true that you've actually used closing remarks that you've put in the mouths of your characters of your books in actual trials in your practice?
Yeah. Well, it's back and forth in that my first trial that I won was an arson case. And I said, where there's smoke, there's reasonable doubt. I then used that in a book. And then I've used that since then, where there's smoke, there's reasonable doubt. They're using smoke and mirrors. And so, I mean, my screenwriting experience has been very helpful as a trial lawyer.
What is that identity, though? What do you go in as, a writer or a trial lawyer?
I'm a trial lawyer. I mean, I make the majority of my income as an attorney. And technically, I'm not a public defender. I have a public defender contract. So I always get, if two people rob a bank, I get the second person. Is the way my contract is. And I go all over New Mexico. And most of my books, though, have been written in hotel rooms. Because if you're staying in a hotel in Roswell, New Mexico, or Clovis, New Mexico, you might as well write a book.
You know, I was listening to a recent interview, John, of yours. You were seated in a Denny's in Truth or Consequences, New Mexico. And apparently this is a place you stop regularly en route to trials in various obscure towns around the state. And you said you'd even use this Denny's in your books. It was kind of a, you know, a character in your books in and of itself. And that you even had a character that you were so enamored of, this Denny's, that you even named one of your characters Denny. I mean,
No. Actually, the story of in the last book in the Shakespeare Incident, best science fiction novel, the name came from my grandfather's joke. The old joke is a guy asks his brother to name the kids, and the first kid is named Denise, and the second kid is named De-Nephew, and De-Nephew became Denny.
Ah.
And so that's in. I wanted to write these two twins that had been separated, and Denise is the lawyer, Denny is the criminal. And sure enough, they meet in a Denny's.
Uh-huh.
So, and if you're in a, and trust me, if you're in a small town, sometimes Denny's is the only place you can eat and know you're going to get good food.
Yeah.
Right.
Well,
right.
I'm a Waffle House kind of guy, but I want to go back to what you just said a little bit earlier about the award-winning novel. So it is bestowed an award on it. Would you have an award-winning novel without the award?
Well, here's the one thing that I've learned about awards. Not necessarily my best books have won. My novel Luna Law won the Hillerman Award in 2017 for fiction. I mean, one of the best books in New Mexico. I was a co-winner that year. And that was a corporate thriller where Luna's kidnapped and Dan, the hero, has to find Luna, to free her. And at the, I sort of went with these paranoid corporate thrillers like The Parallax View and, infiltrating the technology and stuff like that. So I don't love that book, but it won. And I think it won because the ending was just so strong that I set up the first scene. Dan, the hero, has his hand on the throat of the bad guy and says, "Where's my wife?" And the last scene, we find out where his wife is. Mm-hmm. So I try to set things up where I ask a question in the first scene that's answered in the last scene. So that's the other secret to writing an award-winning book.
And does the award matter?
The fact that I won them, let's just say it made me feel that my work had value.
Yeah. Well, it puts another level of stress, right? Here you are doing the work and then somebody recognizes you and now you have to sit and wait to say, oh, did I win or not? That's something else you have to care for in some way.
Well, I literally was putting everything on. If I had won, last year I entered something like 10 contests in 10 categories. And I was a finalist in six categories, and I won one. Had I won the grand prize, I actually would have seriously considered quitting law. But I won a category, which was a big deal. But here's something that your viewers or listeners, I think, would be interested in, is that every once in a while, a book does not fit in a category, or what you do is not going to win. Where my novel Rattlesnake Funeral, I entered it in 6 categories, and it's a legal thriller. It's not a mystery. It's not a crime book. It's not a thriller. So I entered it. It was a finalist in all these categories, but it didn't win because it wasn't a good fit.
Mm-hmm. You know, John, it sounds to me just like the books you write and the character is sort of has this almost noir flavor to it, kind of a classic, 1940s, the attorney or the private eye or the private dick, on the case in the small town, solving the crimes, that kind of thing. It's very romantic. And your own actual life, I did some research and, you're doing as a defense attorney, you have what's called a conflict contract, as you said. I had not heard of this before, but it seems to be a very unique corner of criminal defense. You have up to 20 cases a month. You do everything except murders. You're on the road 2 days a week in courts all over the state. Again, that has the same sort of noir flavor and feel to me, and it probably doesn't seem romantic when you're on the road at 3 a.m. going to your next case, but to the outside world, there's a certain – that's incredibly unique and unlike any law lifestyle I've heard of. Tell us what makes this particular corner of the law distinctive and what you like about it, what you don't like about it.
Well, what I have now appeared in, there are 30 counties in New Mexico. I've appeared in a court in every county of New Mexico except one. Wow. So the good thing about it is, I get sometimes as many as 60 calls a day. And I now am at a point where people know me in the various towns. The good thing about it is I can go into town and win or lose. And then 20 minutes out of town, I'm a stranger again. That to me can actually, so I don't obsess. When I lived in Roswell and worked in Roswell, you couldn't leave because literally you just lost the case and you would see the kid's mom at the gas station or whatever. And that happens every once in a while, but I'm removed. But so I'm not involved in the petty politics of these small towns. And there is, you know, there's a lot of politics everywhere. And I just go in, I do my job, and I leave. So that's,
you like your job?
The things I love about it, and which brings us to the next point, is I started getting very, I know you're an artist, I started getting serious about photography because I was driving at dawn and I would see these incredible New Mexico sunrises and then coming back at sunset. And I started taking pictures and I soon got better and better cameras and learned more about photography. And as a way of relaxing after a horribly tough day, I would find these little lakes or ponds and hit the sunset or see a mountain or whatever. And that gave me, whatever you want to call it, Zen, or a feeling that there was a greater power. So it was almost a religious experience on the road. For example, I go to Alamogordo, New Mexico, which is right by White Sands. And I now have found a place to photograph White Sands National Monument from the highway. So I go there all the time and get these incredible shots.
So what do you stand for? And is there a parallel of what you stand for as an attorney and as an author?
It's a good question. I want people to be treated fairly. And there's more... I'm trying to think of a best way of putting it is people are people. And just because somebody is accused of a crime doesn't mean they're necessarily guilty or a bad person. And I want their rights to be respected. As an author, I don't write these big grand novels. My scope is usually fairly small. Almost all the scenes take place in New Mexico, and I want to focus on people that haven't been focused on, people that have stories to tell that no one seems to care about.
Right on, man. That's well said.
Yep.
Well said indeed. Tell us about one of your epic fails in your life. Either in law, in writing, just something that you really learned a lot from hitting the median at 90 miles an hour.
Well, in terms of, I always say that when I saw my book for the first time, it was not love at first sight. The first draft of Rattlesnake Lawyer, which might actually be valuable now, I made 400 corrections before it was published. I mean, I literally said, "Hi, here are my final edits," and it already went out. So. And the main character, the defendant in that is named Jesus Villalobos, but on the first page it's spelled Jesus Villabobos. And eventually, after I sold out the book, I said, we've got to redo it. And they did. And I had another book called Navajo Repo, which was a thriller where, again, I counted on a publisher to edit it, and they didn't. So I said, we got to redo it. So now do not buy Navajo Repo, buy Navajo Repo Special Edition. Because, I mean, I think we made over 1,000 changes on that one. So as a writer, don't count on other people to edit your stuff.
Yeah.
As a lawyer, know the law and know that this is something else, life imitating art, imitating life, is there's a lawyer somewhere in New Mexico who will say, you can argue. And he'll say, your client is charged with first degree murder. You can argue that he gets to live in Zion for a while and work at the park service and work at a playground. I'm like, oh, that's wonderful. I can argue for that. But of course you can't. It's, you know, if you're charged with a serious crime, there's mandatory time. And I put that whole, you can argue, in several of my books. where a lawyer was essentially lying to me.
So in other words, you're kind of clarifying a lot of the law as you know it. And you're teaching us, you're giving us a sort of a crash course in criminal defense in the arc of your story.
Yeah, that's something that you've got to know what's going on. Where I had to learn the hard way of when people are lying, when people are, you know, when opposing counsel's lying to me, when people, say, well, my cousin's my alibi witness and the cousin's missing. You have to learn, and I don't learn when to follow through on a lead and when not to. So that was something that both law and writing merged together.
Right, right. What's something you're most proud of?
I don't think I've written the perfect novel, but I've written the perfect chapter in several of my books. Nice. Where there's the thrill of the fast reverse. And the other thing I'm proud of is I've had some real serious cases where I've helped people. And that's a really good feeling when you've literally saved a life.
Yeah.
And I've saved a few people, not everyone, but there are people that have lives and, you know, are working and have had families when it was looking like they were going to spend the rest of their lives in prison. And I'm really proud of that.
How do you keep going sometimes when you see the rattlesnake sign, you know, and you're getting that self-doubt because you said just now that you haven't written the perfect novel. How do you push yourself through the self-doubt you have about your skills, about where you want to go? What is it inside?
Well, you've got to figure out, you know, in writing, you have to ask, what's the story about? And, you know, I've had right now I've got writer's block, but I'll be back at it probably next year, where somebody just gave me a great idea where, spoiler alert, Dan is defending Luna on a murder case. Wow, that's it. I mean, I never thought of that, and somebody gave me a good idea. So it's knowing that a good idea will be coming. Hmm. And the other thing about pushing through is my photography is that, and also when you have a horrible day in court and then you leave and you see how beautiful the earth is and you see that sunset, you see that sunrise, and all of a sudden you see something that I've seen rainbows that have just cheered me up after a tough day in court. I mean, the realization is that the guy in jail is not seeing the rainbow, but it's as if God has given me a message that, you know, tomorrow is another day.
Wow, man, you've come a long way since Cornell University. That's impressive. That's super impressive. And what are you looking forward to? What are you excited about? And what's your dream? Like, how's this all going to work out if it works out in your dreamscape?
Well, right now, people who've done stuff you've heard of have optioned my work. Whether anything comes of it, I don't know. In some ways, it's not a deal breaker if nothing happens. I'm now getting to a point with my photography where I think I can sell my work from my adventures, where a judge in one of the towns I go to has a picture of the courthouse that I took on his wall, and that means a lot to me. And I'd like to get some kind of synthesis where I take all my ideas and combine them. And I mean, every week I see this ad for a continuing legal education, which will say something like, how to use storytelling to do closing arguments. Mm-hmm. And I look at these people, and often they're not done by either storytellers or people who've done as many trials as me. So that's something that I'm thinking of doing, is being a jury consultant and using the visual element that I've started, you know, and I've started taking photos seriously since last year. I took a course at an online course at Cornell after I bought my new camera, which was what the start of me taking, it's only been a year, but of taking photography seriously. And now at a point where I can sell stuff.
Perhaps you can be commissioned to do a redo of all the interiors of Denny's in New Mexico.
I hope so. This is a major announcement. The Public Defender Department of New Mexico is looking for photos. And the website, I don't think it's been changed, but a lot of my photos are going to be on their website, where they would have like a town in the plains. It's like, here's their office, and they would show ruins of the Aztec ruins. And I actually deliberately divided up my photos into judicial districts. So, and pictures of the courthouse, and all that should be on the website next year.
That's exciting, John. Didn't I read that you're basically taking a photo of each courthouse in each county that where you're trying cases? Is that something that's happening? Something like that?
Yeah, I did do that, and a lot of times
romantic as well.
Well, some of these are Old West courthouses. Some of them, if I have something that I love, it's puddles. And I have a picture, I don't know whether you put it on your website, of the Albuquerque courthouse reflected in a puddle. The one that's framed in a judge's office is the courthouse where he is, that's reflected in a puddle on the sunset. And it's one of my favorite shots.
Right on.
That's
right
great.
On. And also, your books are available on Amazon. It's Jonathan Miller, Jonathan.
The books are the Rattlesnake Lawyer series, and usually if you just Google Jonathan Miller, Rattlesnake Lawyer, it'll get you there.
Outstanding. Well, my friend, it's a delight to have you join us and share your swan dive. You've got a really interesting thing going. It's quite noble, as well as it's just a good old-fashioned, like, sit down and do the work story, you know, with a beginning, a middle, and an end, and a happy ending, no doubt. That's still to come. And I really appreciate you, and I really admire you. And I just want to say that everybody should work as hard as you do and have the same noble intentions that you do. So thank you for that. And thanks for being a part of Swan Dive.
Hey, everyone. Thank you so much for listening to Swan Dive. If you like what you heard, please rate, review, and share this episode. Also, we are building a new season of Swan Dive. So if you or you know someone who has experienced a swan dive in their life, please hit us up and contact us through our website, www.swandive.us.